Pseudopod, episode 143, May 22nd, 2009. This week's story, The Looking Men, by James R. Christofich. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair, and this week's story comes to us from James R. Christofich. The bulk of James' work to date has been non-fiction for venues like High Country News, but his short story, The Shooting Way, was recently published in Necrotic Tissue magazine, and, along with his appearance here, it hopefully marks the start of a very welcome and very impressive career in modern horror. Your narrator this week is BJ Harrison of the Classic Tales podcast, which, believe me, really does live up to its name. So, cinch your hood on tight and make sure that the medicinal herbs are in place and smouldering gently, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
The Looking Men, by James R. Christofich. Hiram knew his father, Jonah, could not refuse the Looking Men on the night they asked him to help kill William the Reeve. Jonah had been the first villager of Corfe to speak to the captain of the Looking Men, the one called Sir Ethan the Red Greaves, after the Looking Men and their tall war horses arrived by the main road to examine the first deaths from the Black Hand. The wandering friar of Corfe, a red-faced balding man who had summoned the Looking Men, rode behind them on a bony mare. The friar had briefly addressed the free peasants who'd gathered at the mill and promised he would explain all in the morning after the Looking Men had rested. Hiram knew what everybody else knew about the Looking Men. They served the church and bore scars from the Crusades to the Holy Land, but they were also knights, loyal to their King Henry of England, so they could be trusted, and the friar promised they had come for the good of Corfe. But the friar had died that night when the Black Hand laid itself upon him. So it was Jonah and Hiram who had taken Sir Ethan to see what they had found and reported to the friar. A short walk from the village led them to the forest where the sow had been crucified to the walnut tree, her insides spilling like a bundle of wet ropes from a ragged slash in her belly. Thigh bones and cloven hooves were all that remained of her legs after the wolves had done their work.
"Have the boy stand back," Ethan had said.
Jonah motioned his son away. Hiram walked to a nearby oak where he watched and listened carefully.
"You received the friar's summons?" Jonah asked.
The knight ignored the question, picked up a stick, poked beneath the sow's chin, and watched the skin collapse.
"Good fat," Ethan said,
pushing back a length of his long red hair that marked him as a Saxon of the northern lineage.
"The forest is kind to your herds?"
"Yes," Jonah said, staggering in the sudden wind that scattered through the tatters of autumn leaves in the canopy above them. Jonah pulled his hood tighter around his gaunt face, patched with growths of a beard.
"The acorns fall thicker as you move north."
The knight nodded, removed his gauntlet, and reached beneath his cloak to the leather cage that hung from thick straps across his broad, muscular shoulders. When Hiram saw the deep red shade of the gauntlet and the knight's cloak, it reminded the boy of this cycle of the calendar. November, the blood month, when the acorn-fattened hogs were herded back to the village, slaughtered, and salted for winter meat. And the Looking Men wore this color of drying blood. Ethan undid the clasps on the cage's small door, and a fluttering of wings came from under his cloak as he stepped forward. He whispered soothing sounds as he produced a dove with feathers the color of fresh snow. He placed the bird in the palm of his gloved hand, holding the dove by a pair of thin jesses tied to her pink feet. The bird flapped nervously, then settled her pale body as the knight stroked her chest with his forefinger. Slipping his fingers under the bird's wings, he presented her, chest out, like a pilgrim's talisman. The knight guided the dove over the pig's rotting guts, tracing the bird's beak along the gaping wound in the animal's belly, and then over the sow's pale skin.
"Why do you do that?" Jonah asked, hitching his green cloak tighter around his thin body.
"The bird knows signs," Ethan said. "She sees what we cannot. There."
Hiram saw. Strange dark patterns grew along the pale chest and throat of the sow. Hiram thought they looked like black spots or dark, dead leaves that had landed and caught in the pig's wiry hairs. But he soon realized they were actually handprints. The knight reached forward and pulled away some of the blackness, sniffed it, and offered it to Jonah. His father studied it. "Ashes?" he said. Ethan nodded to where many other ashen handprints had spread over the sow's corpse.
"The black hand," he said.
He guided the bird along the rest of the corpse in a cruciform pattern, and then returned the bird to her cage.
"Come back here with two other men," Ethan said. "Cut the animal down, burn it. Bury the ashes at the foot of the tree. Carve a cross from the nearest limb and bury that also."
"The crucifying nails?" Jonah asked, pointing to the iron spikes in the pig's wrists.
"Leave them," Ethan said. "This tree is cursed."
Jonah nodded. He had burned many bodies since the first autumn snow had come in a roaring storm that flashed purple lightning, since Lord DeShansom's manor house was found abandoned on the third Sabbath, since the Black Hand had come to the village. "Yes," Hiram had whispered, "burning will cleanse." The knight cocked his head toward the boy.
"Yes," he said, "that is what we are here to do."
The sow had been one of the many signs that had haunted the villagers of Corf in the weeks after the harvest. Dark wine stored in the clay jars had faded and thinned to water. Pale, wingless bees had wandered over misshapen hives in the western woods. Stalks of pale wheat had grown up from the reaped earth overnight before the grains sprouted berries of blood and the dry stalks vanished to the earth like ghosts. But not until one of the serfs was found dead near the mill, his tongue black and swollen between his teeth, had the Black Hand laid itself upon Corf. Since then, its grip had tightened, but the looking men promised this night would be the last. When Ethan Redgreaves invited Jonah to supper in the field between the manor house and Paulson's farm, he'd asked Jonah to bring someone he trusted. Jonah went to find Hiram at the mill, where the looking men had painted the doorway white. Here, each villager who had not been touched by the Black Hand had reported every night. After the looking men had given proper rites and burned the friar's body, Sir Ethan had gathered Corf beneath the large oak tree at its center and appointed William the Reeve, the elected leader of the peasants to Lord DeShansom, to count each villager as they entered the mill and to bar the door for the night. During the day, the looking men had taken their doves and searched each of the cottages and huts in pairs. They dug through straw mattresses, lifted barrels, stabbed swords through thatched roofs, and listened to the walls. Hiram had heard they were searching for signs that would reveal the servants of the Black Hand. Alan, a freeman farmer who lived distant from the village, shook his head at the order to remain in the mill. Ethan explained the mandate again, but still Alan huffed that he would not be shut up in a short room with sobbing children like some rat in a roof nest. Two nights ago, William could not find Alan in his expected count of 22 from the other six families. The next morning, they found Alan laid before the door, two arrows in his chest, one in his neck.
"We mistook him," Sir Ethan had said. "Two will need to bury this man. Do not leave the mill after dark. We have said this, and this man gave no ear. In the day do what you must, but when the sun reddens, you go to the white door as we have told you."
Hiram remembered this as he walked through the bare field next to his father, the soil frozen to stone beneath his boots. Beyond, the land descended slightly into the village, flanked by deep woods of ash and oak at all sides. After the woods were the fields along the sea cliffs and then the wide ocean. The boy carried a warm iron pot of barley and field roots for the looking men who'd gathered in a ring crouched over their haunches. Hiram had never seen them fully sit. Neither had he seen the men change their clothing or sleep unarmed. There were five looking men, always five. The tallest of them, a dark-haired man named Malcolm, walked toward Jonah and Hiram with his hand raised.
"Surprised you can walk in this cold, eh?"
Malcolm said, grinning against a shard swath of wind.
"Makes you wonder why you bother to heat the pot."
Malcolm smiled as he took the meal from Hiram's offering hands. Jonah handed Malcolm a bread round as wide as his hand.
"A guest is a guest in any weather. My son wanted to be sure you had something better than cold bread."
"Our thanks," Malcolm said.
Malcolm passed the pot and bread to a short, bearded man they called Joseph, who wore a cross carved from seashell and carried only a wooden staff. William the Reeve had told Hiram he thought Joseph might be a priest. The looking men parted the bread evenly and began dipping it into the pot, eating through the steam.
"Do you still have it?"
Malcolm asked, motioning to the boy. Hiram nodded, and from a pouch along his pants he produced a figurine of a sheep, woven from green twigs with dead grass for wool. He handed it to Malcolm, who held it by the shank and examined it.
"This is not the one I made," he said. "You made this, boy?"
"Yes, Sir Knight," Hiram said.
"He's done nothing but shape those things in the evening," Jonah said. "Where did you learn this craft, sir?"
"When I was in the Holy Land," Malcolm said.
"Is that where you got your beads?"
Hiram said, pointing to the knight's leather scabbard, decorated with round beads in iridescent shades of aquamarine, purple, and violet, colors Hiram thought only the sea could hold. Jonah slapped the boy's hand down.
"No trouble in pointing, friend," Malcolm said. "Yes, in a skirmish after Antioch."
"Forgive the boy's curiosity," Jonah said.
Malcolm drank the remnants from the pot and handed it back to Hiram.
"No harm. A curious mind makes for sharp eyes, so I was taught."
Ethan stepped between them. "Sharp eyes are what we need, and so we have called you here, shepherd," he said, "because we know we can trust you, and any in your trust are in ours, agreed?"
Jonah nodded and stepped closer as Malcolm beckoned him.
"Agreed," he said.
"Agreed,"
Hiram said, cradling the warm pot close to his skinny frame.
"My men have found the Black Hand's servant," Ethan whispered in the icy wind. "Tonight we strike him back to hell. I will tell you his name, and you will tell no one. No trap springs for a noisy hunter, eh?"
Hiram nodded. His gaze drifted across the field to the large manor house of Lord de Shansom, that now sat dark and abandoned. The looking men had painted its oak threshold with lamb's blood to remind the villagers that the angel of death had come, and only those touched by its hand could enter there. Jonah and Hiram had served two duties at the manor house to give water to the sick with the long wooden dippers brought by the looking men. But they'd been close enough to see the sick lying inside with black sores the size of eggs swollen in their necks, under their armpits, behind their knees. Others coughed blood into their shaking hands. No villager ever crossed the stone line the looking men had marked around the manor house, and the looking men had provided flagons of mead, cured beef, and sacks of barley for the sick. They'd also brought many soft mattresses of dry, yellow straw and linen. Jonah spoke suddenly.
"How do you know who it might be, Redgreaves?"
Malcolm began tying his dark hair behind him in a leather coil.
"Shepherd, always curious. Nothing to do around those sheep but think, eh?"
Hiram saw his father wince slightly, as though someone had stepped on his foot. He knew his father hated thinking about his sheep,
ever since they had been found dead of the Black Hand in their pen next to their cottage croft on the third morning after the looking men arrived. More than 20 of the animals had died in the cold mud, their tongues hanging black and limp from their mouths like river eels.
"Curious, yes," Ethan said. "But that's why we chose you, shepherd. Look."
The knight pointed to the old Roman road where William the Reeve led a woman, shrouded in one of the thick white cloaks that had been brought by the looking men. Malcolm had explained that the cloaks made those touched by the Black Hand easier to find if they tried to escape the manor house by night and flee to the darkness of the forest. Hiram's sharp eyes could tell by her gait that the woman was weak, and William kept a fair distance from her with his white cane. The Black Hand had certainly touched her. She would be chilled soon, then she would cry for water when the bitter fever struck her.
"Yes,"
Ethan said, scratching his red beard as he watched the woman stumbling with the weight of the condemned.
"The woman is going to the manor of your former lord."
Jonah nearly choked.
"But she has been counted in the mill. No one came in and no one went out of the building."
"The black servant," Hiram choked. "He sleeps in the mill with the rest of us."
"That is the only explanation," Ethan said. "He is certainly feeding and spreading the bitter seed by night from within. And who better knows the flock than its shepherd?"
"The Reeve," Jonah said. "I have seen him cross the stone line where we carted the bodies, and I have seen him touch one of the bodies with his white cane before we burned them. I thought it was amiss at the time, but said nothing.
Calm, Jonah," Malcolm said, pressing his hand over the shepherd's shoulder. "William is a leader among you. You could not have accused him, and he is a good man. No servant of the Black Hand acts of his own will."
"So he will strike again tonight?"
Hiram said. Ethan nodded.
"Likely. The black servants are impatient, but no matter. We will do away with him before he can feed on another and spread the Black Hand's reach."
"Anything I must do, I will do. You know my wife's ashes blacken the pasture,"
Jonas said, motioning to the oxen pasture, where William the Reeve carted the dead on every second morning and burned them, just as the looking men had ordered.
"Then you must listen carefully,"
Ethan said, guiding Jonah and Hiram toward the looking men's circle.
"This is a tight trap. No mistakes now."
In the circle, Jonah shook hands with the other looking men. The first was the quiet Welshman, who steadied his longbow across his lap, next to his bristling quiver. The other, a tall blonde Northman named Snorri, shook Hiram's hand roughly. Tattoos of sea serpents, eyes slanted with fanged jaws gaping, snaked over the man's wrists and arms. Hiram wondered if they would resemble William once the dove revealed him as the black servant that night. His eyes wandered to the looking man's blood cloaks draped over the dove's cages in a perfect ring next to their fire, as though they covered holy shrine. The looking men waited until the moon cleared the trees that night before they went to kill the Reeve. Hiram had watched from the forest edge as the Reeve counted the villagers filing into the mill. The wind galloped tonight, rattling the red and brown remnants of leaves still clinging to the dark oaks. Hiram leaned against Jonah and squeezed tightly around his father's waist. His father parted the boy's hair, sand-colored like his mother's, and wiped dirt from the corners of his hazel eyes.
"Do what they say tonight, Hiram," he said. "Be brave, patient, and pray for good fortune."
"Yes, father," Hiram said.
"And you're not to enter the fighting when it happens," Jonah said. "The knights are having you along only to carry a torch if the battle leads toward the forest."
"Yes, sir," Hiram said.
But Hiram knew he would fight, knight's orders or no, if it meant avenging his mother's death. He was a prize wrestler among the children on holy days, and had been able to serve in Lord de Chansam's winter boar hunts a year earlier than the other village boys. Hooves clopped, and leather slapped steel as Sir Ethan rode in from the southern tree line at a brisk canter, his blood cloak flapping behind, one hand pressed against the leather cage at his ribs. He dismounted and approached with a large coil of rope slung over his shoulder.
"You'll need this," Ethan said, handing the rope to Jonah.
Jonah nodded and began tying the knots around his waist and chest as the looking man had showed him. Hiram made sure the knots could not be seen beneath his father's long woolen jacket. If Jonah needed to escape quickly once the servant revealed itself, the looking men would need to pull him back before he was infected by the Black Hand. Ethan whispered gently into the dove's cage at his side, and then they were moving, Ethan leading Jonah and Hiram with the priest Joseph at the rear. The steel moon guided them past the manor house, where Malcolm waited at his sentry post. Ethan let out a small thrush whistle. Malcolm returned it, then stalked toward the river that flowed past the mill and crouched in a patch of tall, dead grass. After they reached the last house along the road, Ethan turned and halted Jonah. Joseph stationed himself beside a smaller cottage. Hiram gripped his unlit torch anxiously.
"When we walk to the doorway, you trail the rope behind. Leave plenty of slack," Ethan said. "Once inside, I will coax the Reeve to the doorway. When he agrees, you pull on the rope. Once, hard. When my men hear the rope stir, it will signal their attack. It is very important that William know nothing of our plan. If the Black Servant suspects why we are here, the dove will not reveal him. Remember to trail out the rope," Ethan said. "And keep your torch close, boy."
Jonah turned and pressed Hiram to his chest and kissed the boy's hair.
"Pray God he help us," Jonah said. "Stay close, as you've been told."
"I will," said Hiram.
As the looking men entered the mill, Hiram watched his father winding out the rope length by length as though preparing a noose for William the Reeves's gallows. When they reached the mill, Hiram leaned in the doorframe, holding high the torch he'd lit at a nearby watchfire. He saw where William sat on a short wooden stool against the fireside, his white cane leaning against the inside of his leg as he told the children stories from when he'd served the cross in the Holy Land. The other free peasants and villagers busied themselves in their weaving, sewing, and carving, their backs resting against the mill walls. They occasionally listened in when William bared the pale, jagged scar that ran from his wrist past his elbow, what he called his skin trinket, from a Saracen surprise attack. He recounted his march beneath the shining domes at Byzantium and bloody service at Antioch, where he'd fought dark men with skin like leather. A shepherd's young son, Nathan, said,
"My father said everyone's sick because of the Arabia men. He says it's a curse. Said they have demons there that shine like the sun and eat sand."
William opened his mouth to answer, but stopped his speech when he saw Ethan enter the mill.
"William," Ethan said, "you're needed."
The Reeve approached and leaned against the doorway.
"Yes, Master Knight," he said.
"What was the count today?"
The Reeve recited the names of the dead. There had been 7.
"The ashes must be left to lie 2 seasons once we leave," Ethan said.
"Leave?" William said, nearly choking. "You've found the creature?"
"Yes," Ethan said. "We know."
"How?" William said. "And who?"
Ethan reached into the cage at his side, petting the bird through the thin bars.
"Have the ashes done their work?" asked William.
"What work is that?"
Jonah asked. Ethan said,
"When the black servants walk in their human skin, they return to the ashes of the dead sick like a wolf to blood, no knowing why, not to eat them. We have tried poisoning them in the past. It doesn't work."
Ethan untied the cage, carefully cradling the dove in his palm. He pressed her beak to his forehead, spoke soft words in Latin, kissed her pale breast.
"But we know the black servants return to the ashes of the dead."
Hiram remembered what he had seen at the sow's crucifixion, how the bird was able to reveal the ashes of the dead in the shape of the black servant's hands that had touched the pig's body. The boy studied the reeve as Ethan held the bird as he'd done with the crucified sow. Nothing happened. There were no ashen markings on the reeve's hands. Ethan turned his head to Jonah, and Hiram saw an intensity in the knight's eyes that had remained hidden until now, like a hawk suddenly unhooded.
"I am sorry, brother,"
Ethan said, eyeing Jonah's hands. Hiram took a small step backward. Dark ashes sifted between his father's flexing fingers.
"What? Wait!"
Jonah said. Ethan thrust the dove into Jonah's face, and the bird's chest erupted in a mist of hot blood that painted the shepherd's forehead and eyes. Jonah staggered backward, blinded.
"Hold the boy!"
Ethan bellowed, casting aside the dead bird and drawing his sword, the blade dim in the firelight. He shoved Hiram back into William's waiting arms. Rough hands clamped down over Hiram's shoulders and pulled him toward the reeve's chest. Then a scream came from Jonah that was both death rattle and birth cry. His mouth gaped wide enough to swallow a newborn pig, spurting thick gray foam that stank like fish guts. Teeth, thin and hollow like viper's fangs, folded down from the roof of his mouth, and small gouts of black fluid spilled from their tips. His eyes were slotted like a goat's and glowed an unholy purple.
"Now!"
Ethan yelled, and Hiram heard a tumbling sound as the rope his father had been trailing suddenly whipped across the floor, drew taut, and his father flew out into the night. Hiram screamed and flailed and struggled against William's grip, and though the reeve's hands were strong from years of hard labor, Hiram could feel their slowness. He jerked upward and spun hard to his knees, striking with his elbows as he pulled free.
"No, boy!"
William yelled, but Hiram was already running at the doorway, his eyes following the rope to where it had been tied to the team of horses that had dragged his father into the middle of the road. His father lay still, his hands bent to his sides, while Joseph pulled a long hunting knife and cut the thick rope. Jonah rose to his feet just as Hiram heard a stirring in the thatch of a cottage across the road, and then a tight groaning sound like a bow being drawn. The Welshman archer. An arrow whistled into Jonah's throat, punching through to the feathers. He spun wheezing toward the doorway as Ethan ran at him. Another arrow pierced the shepherd's beneath the shoulder, where Hiram had been taught to aim when hunting hares, where the heart beat beneath. The boy saw Ethan's sword leap and slash down Jonah's chest, crashing him to his knees. The looking men had killed his father.
"No!"
Hiram cried, running toward the men, his hands balled into fists, his only weapons. Two more arrows pierced his father, low near the kidneys. He grunted and twitched. Hiram's eyes stung with tears, and his knees knocked in his reckless sprint toward the road.
"Stop him!"
Ethan barked, but the boy was too fast, too desperate in his panicked love. Spots of sunlight danced at the edges of his vision. From those edges, Hiram saw Malcolm running from the tall grass along the creek. Hiram ran on, stumbling, choking on tears and snot and sweat. Suddenly, his father burst to his feet, roaring like Hiram imagined dragons must roar.
"Duh!"
Hiram cried. The servant turned and faced Hiram, and the boy felt his heart trampled by some invisible hoof. This creature was no longer his father. It was all too fast. The servant's arm rose like a talon. Malcolm gripped Hiram in his gauntlets, turned himself toward the blow. A sound like an axe splitting a beehive came as the talon struck Malcolm's head and took the top of it away. They fell to the earth, the dead knight's arms still clasped tightly over Hiram's body. Salty warmth spread over Hiram's face and neck as the servant reared over him. Then it grunted, pausing as though to sniff the air, as Ethan's sword point drove through its chest from behind.
The creature swiveled, cupped the knight's neck, and tossed him to the mill's high roof as easily as Hiram threw pulled turnips. Hiram choked on the scent of blood and fish guts under the witchlight of the creature's eyes. The servant took a long stride toward him. Then Joseph was running between them with his staff raised. The servant struck as Joseph fainted and smashed his staff into the servant's face, crushing the left eye socket. An arrow whistled past Hiram and lanced the creature's other eye. The servant thrashed blindly as Ethan leapt down from the thatched roof. Somehow hearing the knight's footfall, the servant turned and charged Ethan, gargling and roaring. Ethan waited, his hand wandering to a bone-handled huntsman's knife at his side. When the servant struck, the knight sidestepped, drew the knife, and stabbed it through the creature's ear. The servant fought drunkenly now along the river as the looking men trailed slowly behind with Joseph at the rear carrying Hiram's lit torch. Hiram watched the servant, staggering. Ethan's sword glinting in its chest under the torchlight, arrows bristling over its skin that had darkened to the color of ashes. Snorri, the tall Northman, strode out of the darkness and threw the servant on its side in a wrestler's maneuver. He gripped the thing by its hair and dragged it to the riverbank, forcing the servant's face into the water. Hiram could not look away. "What?" Hiram murmured. "What's..." Hiram heard a crunch in the earth, feet landing, a clatter of wood. Arrows. The archer, the Welshman, was over him with a torch, his pale blue eyes studying him. "Lie still," the archer said. "You only did what I would have done. This will be a hard night for you, but let the Almighty's will be done." The archer tugged at Malcolm's blood cloak and cast it over what remained of the dead man's face. He pointed to the river. "These things cannot be killed by spear, blade, or bow. You can merely cripple them," he said. "Drowning is the only way we've seen them die." As the looking men dragged the servant's body to the bank, Ethan pulled out his sword and Joseph pressed his shell crucifix to the servant's forehead. The priest spoke Latin words and stepped away. Then Ethan severed the head. Stooping over the servant's chest, Ethan stabbed and cut with the huntsman's knife and pulled out the heart. Snorri pried open the jaws of the severed head and Ethan placed the heart inside, as though slipping a snared rabbit into a sack. The knight hefted the head by the hair while Snorri threw the body over his back. The looking men walked toward the mill. Hiram felt a stone over his chest growing heavier as they drew closer.
"Have the Reeve take the boy inside," Ethan said. "We have our last work here."
"Yes," the archer said. "I'll be at the manor house." He looked down at Hiram. "Your father has forgiven his sins. He will wait for you in paradise. His soul never knew the wrong the black servant did, never knew what had planted itself within his flesh. No one ever knows."
The sunspots returned to Hiram's vision as Joseph and Snorri lifted Malcolm's body over one of the horses. Ethan lit torches at the watchfire outside the mill and handed them to each man. The looking men walked toward the manor house, their torches aloft like fiery pennants. Snorri and Joseph trailed behind, leading the horses that carried Malcolm's body and Jonah's headless corpse. The leather cages tied to the saddles squeaked and rattled with the sound of rustling wings. Murmurs came from inside the mill as villagers gathered at the doorway to watch the torches grow smaller and smaller in the darkness. Then they flickered, flew through the air, and light bloomed orange and fierce, licking and curling from the windows of the manor house. Screams rose above the flames, and Hiram could see bright shapes scattering and falling within. One of the sick men, glowing with tongues of flame like the seraphim, jumped from a window and ran through the main yard until the archer shot him, and he fell burning into the dirt path. The sunspots in Hiram's eyes sparkled like dances of light on waves as he turned his eyes toward the cold earth, wishing he could bury himself in it. As the Reeves's arm closed around him, Hiram remembered the linen mattresses the looking men had brought for the sick, how they coated the floor with clean yellow straw and told the sick and dying that they must keep the rooms dry. The looking men said it was a cure devised by the saints.
Superstition is a framework we hang our universes off. It's invisible and different for everyone and frequently absolutely illogical. But tell that to the football player who takes his hands a certain way, the Thai boxer who has to fiddle with the ropes for a full minute before stepping into the ring, or the author who needs a certain type of pen, a certain type of music, a certain number of cups of coffee. Superstition is the desktop theme we choose for our lives, a means of stamping our identities on the world. It tells us a lot about ourselves, and sometimes it tells us much, much more than we want to hear. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to go turn Thricewise Widdershins and listen to If You Want Blood by AC/DC, because that's really the only way I can start the day. Pseudopod relies on you to pay our authors, our server costs, our ninjas, our gambling debts, and of course the fuel for the pseudojet. We're the engine, but you are the fuel. Well, actually, your money's the fuel for the pseudojet, and if you like this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise you won't regret it. Whilst you're there, why not go take a look at poddisc.com, where you can get the archive discs for Escapepod and Pseudopod. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated, and is released under a Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod is reluctantly prepared to listen, so please, tell us of your dragon.